Welcome to this custom tailored deep dive. We are so glad you're here. Today, our mission is to unpack a completely counterintuitive approach to leadership, success, and how we handle pressure in the workplace.
Yeah, it's a really incredible topic. We're exploring a truly fascinating piece of writing by Leo Bodary.
Right. It's called When the Game Feels Easier Than Practice: What Leaders Get Wrong About Performance. And to really understand this massive blind spot in the modern office, we kind of have to start somewhere entirely different.
Somewhere you wouldn't expect for a corporate leadership deep dive, right?
Exactly. We are starting on the basketball court. Because if you watch elite college basketball, especially during the absolute frenzy of March Madness, there's this one quote that players from the top programs just repeat constantly.
And it sounds completely bizarre on its face.
Right. They step off the court after this grueling high-stakes game in front of millions of people. They find a microphone and they tell reporters, the games are easier than our practices.
Which is wild. But when you hear a player make that claim, you really have to stop and think about the sheer mechanics of what the coaching staff is actually doing behind closed doors.
Yeah. What are they doing to make the game feel easy?
Well, they're deliberately placing their players in seemingly impossible situations. It is a manufactured crucible.
Oh, wow. A manufactured crucible. I like that.
Yeah. They are designing an environment specifically to prepare those athletes for the absolute worst-case scenarios that might unfold during a live game.
And Bodary's article gives this incredible concrete example of this. It's from the men's regional final between the UConn Huskies and the Duke Blue Devils.
A massively high-pressure situation.
Totally. So picture the scene for a second. Season is on the line. The clock is melting away down to mere seconds. The pressure in that arena is physically suffocating, and the noise is just deafening.
Right. It's the ultimate game moment.
Exactly. And in that exact moment, Alex Caraban, who is a senior and a seasoned veteran on the UConn team, has the basketball. But instead of forcing a hero shot to secure his own legacy, he passes the ball out to Braylon Mullins.
Who is a freshman.
Right, a freshman. But he has a clearer, albeit much longer shot, with no defender immediately in his face. So Mullins gets the ball unexpectedly, with the entire season hanging in the balance, and he just doesn't panic. He sinks the game-winning basket.
Which is just incredible poise.
Right. Why does he do that? Because he leaned on hundreds of demanding repetitions.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's unpack this. It actually reminds me of a runner who trains every single day wearing a 20-pound weighted vest.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Yeah. So when they're grinding through the hills on a random Tuesday morning, it's just miserable. Every step is an absolute struggle. Their lungs are burning. Their legs are heavy.
Because of the artificial weight.
Exactly. But then race day arrives. They take the weighted vest off. They step up to the starting line. And suddenly, the actual event feels shockingly light.
Right. The gravity of the race hasn't changed. The distance is the exact same.
Right. But their capacity to handle it has been artificially expanded by the weight of their practice.
What's fascinating here is how clearly this illustrates the divide between elite athletic environments and the modern corporate environment. I mean, elite sports programs intentionally manipulate the variables of their daily environment to be significantly more demanding than the games themselves.
So they're making it artificially harder.
Exactly. The pace of a practice scrimmage is engineered to be faster than a real game. The defensive pressure is tighter. The coaching standards are entirely uncompromising.
Wow.
So by the time those players step onto the court under the brightest lights, their neurological response to extreme stress is fundamentally blunted. Their brains literally don't register panic because they've already survived something harder.
They've already worn the weighted vest.
Yes, exactly. But that manufactured crucible exposes a massive blind spot when we step off the hardwood and into the corporate boardroom, because corporate leaders tend to do the exact opposite.
Okay, so let's look at that modern office environment. It really comes down to how we define the word support in those two different arenas, doesn't it?
It really does. On the court, support means pushing someone to their absolute limit so they are ready.
Right. But in a cubicle or, on a Zoom call, support has morphed into something entirely different.
Yeah. The source text identifies this phenomenon as the comfort trap.
The comfort trap.
Right. In the modern workplace, well-meaning leaders try to create the conditions for success by systematically removing friction. Like, they constantly try to streamline processes.
Oh, yeah. Always streamlining.
Right. They invest heavily in new software to eliminate confusion, and they try to smooth out every conceivable bump in the road. But the fundamental error is equating support with ease.
Right. They think making the daily job easier is the literal definition of supporting the employee.
Which is a trap.
It makes me think of bowling with the bumper rails up. Like, if you were a manager, you might put the bumpers in the gutters so your team hits some pins every time. They might even bowl a high score.
Sure, it looks good on paper.
But they aren't actually learning the physics of bowling. They're learning a false physics.
Yes.
So the moment they enter a real tournament and those bumpers disappear, they are going to throw a gutter ball because they never learned how to correct their own mistakes.
That is a beautiful metaphor for the consequences of the comfort trap. By systematically removing barriers and trying to eliminate all discomfort, leaders unintentionally create an environment where employees are utterly unprepared for the actual game moments of their work.
Because the real work isn't just, you know, filling out a spreadsheet in a quiet room.
Exactly. The real game moments are those incredibly difficult conversations with a furious client. Or the intense cross-functional tension when two departments have conflicting goals and finite budgets.
Oh, for sure. Those high-stakes execution moments, like a product launch where a dozen things go wrong at once.
Right. And when employees falter in those moments, we tend to blame their capability. But it's rarely a lack of inherent capability. It's a lack of preparation.
They've never been asked to perform with the bumpers down.
Exactly. They haven't worn the weighted vest.
Okay, wait. I am genuinely struggling with this. Let me play devil's advocate for you listening. Because if I look at the average modern team, they are already overwhelmed.
Oh, definitely.
People are juggling 100 tasks. Their inboxes are overflowing. They are borderline burnt out. If a leader intentionally makes a project harder, like if they add friction on purpose just to build character, that sounds like a fast track to a mass exodus.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
Right. Nobody wants a manager who introduces pointless bureaucracy just to make them sweat. So how do you introduce friction without just breaking an already exhausted team?
Your confusion gets to the very heart of the issue, and making that distinction is critical. The text is very careful about this shift in mindset. We're absolutely not talking about adding meaningless hurdles or pointless bureaucracy.
Yeah, good, because that would be awful.
Unnecessary friction is making someone fill out a 10-page form in triplicate for a $20 expense, or making them use a clunky, outdated software system.
Yeah, that just makes everyone miserable.
Right. That doesn't prepare you for anything. It just drains your cognitive energy and causes burnout. The text argues for a shift toward what they call desirable difficulty.
Desirable difficulty.
Yeah. Leaders need to stop asking the default question, how do we make this easier for our people? And instead start asking, how do we prepare our people for what this work will actually demand?
Okay. The distinction is between unnecessary friction and desirable difficulty.
Exactly. Let's break down why desirable difficulty works on a cognitive level. When you just hand someone the answer, or you smooth out a process so it requires zero thought, their brain doesn't encode the information deeply.
They just kind of go through the motions.
Right. But when someone has to wrestle with a problem, when they have to retrieve information under slight strain or defend their logic in a room full of skeptical peers, it actually strengthens the neural pathways associated with that skill.
So having to justify your strategic proposal isn't pointless bureaucracy.
No, that is desirable difficulty. It prepares you for the realities of a volatile market. It's about intentionally introducing challenges that mirror the high-stakes situations employees will inevitably face.
But placing those challenges in a setting where they can still learn and adjust without burning the company down.
Precisely.
So if we've established that we need preparation over comfort and desirable difficulty over easy bumper bowling, how do we actually practice this in a standard office setting?
That's the big question.
Yeah, because we can't blow a whistle and make the marketing team run wind sprints in the conference room. How do knowledge workers actually practice?
Well, the source material is highly specific about the application here. Practice in a corporate organization does not mean running detached theoretical simulations.
We aren't doing trust falls at an offsite retreat and calling it team building.
No, definitely not. It involves embedding structured challenges into the everyday realities of the role long before the stakes get critical. You use the existing framework of the workday, but you dial up the intensity and the expectation in controlled, deliberate ways.
Okay, let's put this into a real scenario. Imagine a standard Tuesday morning meeting. The usual operating procedure is, you know, the manager stands at the front, clicks through a slide deck, and gives a staged update while everyone else zones out.
We've all been in that meeting.
Yes. So how do we introduce desirable difficulty there?
You transform that meeting into an arena for genuine dialogue. The manager stops accepting simple status updates and starts probing into the assumptions behind the update. You ask people to verbally defend their thinking.
See, here's where it gets really interesting for me, because the text specifically highlights the necessity of encouraging dissent.
Yes.
And in so many corporate cultures, arguing or dissenting is viewed as a disruption. It's seen as a headache. I mean, HR might even get involved if people are clashing too much in a meeting.
Right. Conflict is usually seen as a negative.
But Bottery is suggesting we need to reframe that entirely. Workplace arguments, when structured and respectful, are actually vital practice for better decision-making.
Think about the psychological mechanism behind that. Why does encouraging dissent work? Because when people are forced to defend their ideas out loud against intelligent pushback, it triggers higher-order executive functions in the brain.
Oh, wow. So it's actually changing how their brains are working in the moment.
Exactly. They aren't just reciting facts. They are actively building cognitive resilience. If a team never disagrees in a low-stakes Tuesday morning meeting, they won't have the conversational muscles required to handle a massive high-stakes disagreement during a crisis.
You'll just freeze up.
Yes, they will either default to groupthink to keep the peace, or they will completely fracture.
That makes so much sense. Another practical method the article brings up is setting artificially tighter timelines for internal reviews.
Oh, that's a great one. Compressing the time allowed introduces pressure in a highly controlled way.
Because under severe stress, human beings experience cognitive narrowing, right? We get tunnel vision.
We do. And by simulating a tight external deadline internally, you force the team to practice ruthless prioritization. You force them to communicate efficiently when they don't have the luxury of time.
So when a real client demands an impossible turnaround,
the team's nervous system has already adapted to that pace.
Amazing. The text also talks about rotating leadership roles in team discussions. Like, the manager physically passes the baton.
Right. Someone else has to lead the meeting, manage the room, guide the agenda.
And deal with the blank stares from their coworkers.
Exactly. It's not easy.
And the manager also forces the team to navigate ambiguity together. They give them a messy problem and say, figure it out, instead of providing a step-by-step map.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this profoundly evolves how we understand the leader's role in a modern organization.
How so?
Well, traditionally, we view the leader as the ultimate decision maker, or, you know, the chief problem solver who swoops in to save the day.
Hero.
Right. But this approach requires the leader to become a designer of environments. They are the architect of the practice field. And they must walk an incredibly delicate tightrope.
Because of the balance between pressure and comfort.
Exactly. Introducing too much pressure without the necessary psychological support creates fear, anxiety, and eventually paralyzing disengagement.
But conversely, providing too much comfort without introducing any challenge breeds stagnation and fragility.
Yes. When a leader masters that balance, they aren't merely managing outcomes, they are manufacturing readiness.
Okay, so the leader is the architect. They design the challenging environment, they set the tight deadlines, they demand real dialogue, and they step back so the team can wrestle with the ambiguity.
Right.
But when the actual crisis hits, when it is game day and a project is actively collapsing, who is actually guiding the employees through the fire?
That is the million-dollar question.
Because the answer brings us to what might be the single biggest blind spot in corporate training. It is the coworkers sitting right next to you.
The source material focuses heavily on the role of peer dynamics here. I mean, organizations routinely spend millions of dollars and dedicate huge portions of their budget to top-down leadership development.
Training the managers, the directors, the executive suite.
Exactly. And in doing so, they completely underestimate the sideways dynamic.
The sideways dynamic.
Right. When the pressure is truly on, when the client is furious and the timeline is blown, employees do not organically look up the organizational chart for guidance. They look sideways.
They take their cues from the people in the trenches with them.
Yes.
They look at their peers to see if they should be panicking.
Exactly. Because we are deeply social creatures.
Yeah.
Emotion and behavioral cues are highly contagious among peers. This is actually rooted in evolutionary psychology and social referencing.
Social referencing. Okay, explain that.
When an ambiguous high-threat situation occurs, our brains look for the person in our immediate line of sight to gauge the appropriate emotional response.
Should I be freaking out right now?
Right. And if your coworkers aren't used to challenging one another or working through tension constructively, they're not going to magically start doing it during a crisis.
The default response will just be self-preservation, finger-pointing, or total paralysis.
Yeah, the contagion of panic takes over.
That is terrifying.
It is. But consider the alternative. If they've been practicing this consistently, if they've been engaging in real dialogue, arguing constructively, and navigating ambiguity together in those designed environments we just talked about.
Something incredibly powerful happens. The team itself becomes the preparation.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? I want you to think about your own daily work life. We expend an enormous amount of mental energy trying to manage upwards.
Oh, constantly.
We obsess over how to impress our bosses, how to communicate perfectly with leadership, and how to make sure our performance reviews look stellar to the people above us.
Right.
But our ultimate success in those critical game moments actually depends on how we challenge and support the peers sitting right next to us. Our readiness is inextricably tied to their readiness.
Let's tie this directly back to the mechanics of that incredible UConn versus Duke anecdote from the beginning of our analysis.
Oh, yeah, the basketball game.
Right. Analyze the final seconds of that play. That game-winning buzzer beater was not an example of players stopping, looking over at the bench, and waiting for the coach to give them top-down instruction.
There's absolutely no time for that in a live game. The coach can't save them.
The coach's job was already done. The execution belonged to the peers. It was a senior player, Alex Caraban, trusting a freshman, Braylon Mullins, in the most high-stakes, terrifying moment of the entire season.
And he trusted him because they had practiced that exact scenario sideways together hundreds of times.
Yes. They had challenged each other, supported each other, and built an unbreakable peer dynamic long before the stadium lights ever turned on. As the text explicitly and powerfully states, teams don't rise to the occasion. They fall to the level of their preparation.
Wow. Teams fall to the level of their preparation. That is a brutal truth. It strips away the myth of the heroic last-minute performance.
It really does.
It forces a reckoning, asking you to evaluate not just what you're doing, but how you are interacting with the people around you every single day.
Yeah.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want you to take a hard look at your own professional world. Whether you're leading a massive global department, prepping for a tense cross-functional meeting tomorrow morning, or simply trying to navigate your daily tasks, ask yourself, are you seeking the comfort trap?
Are you just trying to keep the bumper rails up and make things as frictionless as possible?
Or are you actively designing for readiness? Embrace the friction of practice. Make each other better, because that sideways accountability is the ultimate peer advantage.
In a truly high-performing team, accountability isn't a top-down function reserved exclusively for the person with the highest title. Readiness is built when peers learn how to step in, speak up, and support one another in real time. The leader might set the stage, but the team executes the play.
So true. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to chew on. We've talked extensively about how teams fall to the level of their preparation and how those sideways peer dynamics, the ability to look at your coworker and gauge their reaction, are the absolute key to success.
Right.
But what happens to that readiness when remote work or asynchronous communication strips away those daily sideways glances?
Oh, that's a tough one.
Right. How do you simulate high-stakes tension, and how do you build that crucial unspoken peer trust when your team only ever interacts through text on a screen, separated by miles and time zones? It's a whole new type of weighted vest, isn't it?
It really is.
The next time you're tempted to save your team by stepping in and instantly fixing a problem for them, step back. Let them struggle a little. It might be the best support you can possibly give them. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you next time.